Hello and welcome to the ISBA Bursacast Friday Supplement Special. It is a working title, so bear with me. Anyway, today we're going to be speaking to Nigel Alwyn Foster from Re-Energize. They are a decarbonisation school specialist, and today we're going to be discussing a number of topics surrounding sustainability, net zero, both for carbon and energy, and the importance of estate-wide holistic approaches in dealing with this topic. For many bursars, this can seem hugely intimidating, as it just seems insurmountable given the size of sites or the age of buildings, listed, whatever. We get into all of it today. And with all of this to look forward to, why wait? Here's the podcast. So, Nigel, thank you very much for joining us on another Bursacast, and this time a sector special, on sustainability and carbon neutrality and all of these important topics that I suspect bursars are loath to have to worry about, but actually are hugely important and quite difficult to get right.
Leo, thanks very much. And it's very good to be here. And it's interesting that you should put it like that, because I would agree. I'm afraid that a lot of the things that we're going to need to talk about, if not today, then over the coming weeks, months and years, are expensive. They are a nuisance. They are disruptive to the school. They are all the kinds of things. I mean, some of them are great and there's educational value in this, but a lot of the things that need to be done are the sorts of things that I suspect that bursars and their ilk would rather not be having to do. But the simple truth of the matter is that if we are to get as a nation to net zero carbon by 2050, or if you're a bursar in Scotland by 2045, 5 years earlier, these things need to be done. There's no getting away from it. So it's worth talking about them early.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things that I suspect is not top of the list, because we've got things like TPS and VAT worries and financial concerns. But actually, this really is a financial concern, and one that, as you say, is going to cost an awful lot. And we'll get into that in a second about the details of it. But to start with, could you give a little bit of background about Re-Energize, which is obviously, you know, the company that you're with? How can Re-Energize help independent schools? Why should we listen to you, as it were?
We describe ourselves as the architects and enablers of education sector net zero plans and programs. And our focus is on the retrofit of complex, multifaceted and challenging school estates. The typical school estate in the independent education sector, with some original main buildings, which often as not are listed, meaning there's a limit to what you can do to them. And then the estate has grown over time and there's a variety of buildings. And ultimately, it all needs to be net zero carbon, which means that the estate can no longer rely on fossil fuels for a fossil fuel plant for all its heat, transport and power needs. What can Re-Energize do? Our intent is to ensure that the schools do not waste time or money on expensive dead ends or mistakes. We are a team of engineers and strategists and project managers, and we like to form long-term relationships with schools. So we like to be in at the start of the process, developing what we nowadays call the estate decarbonisation plan, which is a fairly new beast on the block. It's not the sort of thing that was being talked about 2, 3, 4 years ago, but now it is absolutely central to school planning. It's rather like an architect's master plan, except that instead of dealing with buildings, the look and feel of the buildings, the use of the building, the spaces in between, how the flow around the school estate, all those sorts of important things that happen in an architect's master plan, we're peeling back the skin and looking at what is happening underneath, what's happening inside the buildings in terms of utilities, what's happening underground, all those sorts of things. Kind of thing that an architect would normally probably put into the hands of a competent M&E consultant and practitioner. So we're doing that kind of thing, except that our focus is on decarbonisation rather than more conventional M&E, if I could put it like that. And our intent, I know it's a long answer to a pretty straightforward question, but our intent is to be as frank and forthright as we can and basically try and see schools right. And it's actually a very exciting environment in which to operate because it's all rather new. We're all learning. Schools are learning. Bursars are learning. If you're a bursar, the chances are that you have got plenty of experience in overseeing new builds. But the chances also are that in your time as a bursar, you're probably going to only see through one round of estate decarbonisation because you only need to decarbonise an estate once. So the majority of bursars, estate staff and other school staff have relatively little understanding of all this. Clearly on the supplier consultant side, as you would expect, we have more of an understanding, but we're still all learning. And we've got lots of school clients now. And every time we do an estate decarbonisation plan and every time we get involved in managing the projects that arise from those plans, we're all learning lessons. And I think that's true right across net zero throughout the United Kingdom. It's a bit like the being on the frontier, except it's not the Wild West quite.
Almost. Okay, sure. That gives a good understanding of what Re-Energise really offers. And then this whole project of decarbonisation can seem overwhelming, and I'm sure it does to many. But can you break down, obviously there's no one size fits all, but what is the general process? Or where's a good starting point, let's say, for bursars to really just even start thinking about this topic?
I think I'd start by just crystallising the way in which schools use energy. And if you just look at it in headline terms, actually it's fairly straightforward. You need to use heat. You require heat, heating, space heating and hot water for your buildings. You require power. And you require transport and each of those things. And that's all there is. And then you need to control those things. And you need to make sure that you're using your energy efficiently. And you need to measure what you're doing so that you know how well you are progressing towards the eventual goal, which is net zero carbon. Each of those aspects of energy usage on a school estate needs to be dealt with in a particular way. And that thing that we call the estate decarbonisation plan is a logical way of tackling the issue on an estate-wide basis. And if we were to look at a carbon footprint for a typical independent school, whether it's a boarding school or a day school or got a proportion of boarding, if you look at the carbon footprint across all the ways in which greenhouse gases are generated on the school estate, you will nearly always find that the major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, certainly on a boarding school, is the generation of heat. That is typically, in a boarding school, 40, 45, in some cases, 50% of the overall carbon footprint, if it's been measured correctly. It's also that part of the carbon footprint which it is entirely in the gift of the school as to what they do about it. I wish I could show your audience a typical carbon footprint, and I have done so in various talks that I've done from time to time. But if we were looking at that carbon footprint, it would show heating, as I've said, as that major component of the carbon footprint. It would show grid power, but typically that's only about 10% of the overall carbon footprint. It would show school-owned transport, and typically that is no more than 5% of the total school carbon footprint, often less than that. So in the wider scheme of things, actually rather insignificant. It doesn't mean that nothing needs to be done about it, but it's not the big issue. The big issue is heating. And then everything else is what we call in sort of trade terms, those who deal with this day in, day out, everything else is scope three emissions. So it's all those emissions which are not directly generated by the school, but they are part of the school's business because they relate to supplying the school and they relate to the operation of the school. So things like commuting to and from the school, staff and students commuting to and from the school, parents, the school's catering, waste, water, school trips, going to sports matches, that sort of thing. Those are all part of scope three emissions and they all need to be dealt with, but the big issue will be heating. So when we look at how to decarbonize a school estate, we start by looking at what is the plan for the heating. And there are various options. I don't think it's probably not appropriate to sort of go through all the detail now. We can do that later. You can call me in your own time if you want, and we can talk about that at great length. But what we do to the heating and what we need to do to decarbonize the transport will all have an impact on the power usage on the school estate, and 9 times out of 10, more power than is currently being used by the school estate will be required to be delivered to the school estate, either courtesy of the grid or by the school generating its own power on site, or more likely a combination of both. All of that needs to be integrated in this thing called the Estate Decarbonisation Plan. And once the plan has been devised, then the various projects need to be implemented over time. I'd also add that drawing up a plan, and you'll sense that I'm probably giving this thing called the Estate Decarbonisation Plan a bit of a plug, and I am, because I think it's important that schools plan. If you plan early, that does not mean to say you have to start implementing early, but if you plan early for these big ticket items that in most cases are going to cost the school concerned millions of pounds to implement, expenditure that was not anticipated a few years ago, but now at some stage has to be done. If you plan early, it means that there will not be the financial shocks in the future, and bursars, senior leadership teams and governing bodies will be able to adjust the school's long-term budget so that it can all be accommodated. I'm not sure if that helps or not. I could obviously talk for England about all this, and you probably don't want me to do so.
No, of course. And I think that's a really good kind of understanding of where is a place to start. And clearly this plan is it. And, you know, time spent in preparation prevents poor performance. So that's definitely something to take out of it. But something that in our discussions we've had, at, you know, whether it been at conferences or whatever it might have been, you always mentioned that there's a lot of, dare I say, misinformation regarding reducing carbon emissions, whether that's in energy providers or brokers, whatever it might be. What are some of the common pitfalls or mistakes, or even just complete fallacies that you're seeing time and time again?
That's a dangerous question to answer, because what I don't want to sound like is someone who just sort of knocks schools.
No, do it. That's why we're here.
The kind of the I told you so is never really that helpful. But it is the case that schools often get sidetracked by things that are not going to make the difference that they think they're going to make. And I'd like to introduce a couple of terms which might help. Well, three, actually. One is net zero carbon. And net zero carbon means that the school ceases to rely on fossil fuels for all its energy uses. And the way that you achieve that is you remove all the fossil fuel usage on the school estate. And then, assuming that there is a small irreducible minimum which still requires fossil fuel usage, you engage in carbon offsetting to account for that bare minimum. I would say that carbon offsetting should be an absolutely last resort, because if we all just said, right, we're just going to offset all the carbon we use, then actually all we'd be doing is kind of moving carbon around the world, metaphorically speaking, and there'd be no reduction in carbon and other like emissions at all. So it would be a completely pointless exercise. So one of the issues to watch out for is don't think that you're going to become a net zero carbon school simply by offsetting. The second thing is to understand that net zero carbon has the goal of removing the generation of, well, we call them carbon emissions. It's really greenhouse gas emissions, but carbon is the most prevalent. So we talk about carbon emissions. So that's net zero carbon. And it's done to get rid of carbon emissions. Another term which is worth schools understanding is what I would call net zero for energy. Some people just call it net zero energy. Some people, perhaps unhelpfully, just shorten it to net zero. We get confusion between net zero carbon and net zero energy. Net zero for energy means that a school generates the same volume of energy that it uses. And we're normally talking about grid power, or power, I should say. So it generates the same amount of power that it uses, but it's net as opposed to zero energy, because it's not, strictly speaking, a self-sufficient school. Schools are not going to get to a point where they are no longer connected to the grid. That would be extremely challenging to achieve. They're going to need to rely on grid power, but some schools will be fortunate, and they will be able to get to a stage where they generate as much electricity on site as they use in a given period. So some of the time they're exporting the power that they generate, some of the time they're importing power from the grid. But the point is that financially, it adds up and it balances off. So that's net zero for energy. And the reason for embarking on that is to save the school money. And you can embark on the two things at the same time. Net zero carbon, on balance, certainly at the moment, probably will not save the school money, but it needs to be done because in order to get to net zero as a nation and globally, we've all got to do it, including at home. Net zero energy, and the two things overlap. Imagine two circles in a Venn diagram. Net zero energy is a thing to do to reduce the operating costs in a school. And it's the sort of thing that you probably want to get on with straight away. And examples of on-site power generation would be putting up solar PV, solar photovoltaic arrays. Some lucky sites, you might put up wind generation, which where it can work is a very efficient and effective generator of energy. So that is net zero for energy. And then the third thing is the broader topic of sustainability. And a lot of schools, when they're talking about sustainability, are thinking about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And you, of course, Leo, will know straight away that there are 17 of those. But if you look at the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, you'll find that net zero carbon only cuts across six of them. At least it did last time I sort of checked on the table. The others are the sorts of things that are of significant interest to the school in a broader sense of educating children, of teaching children to be good global citizens. And actually, some of them are just very interesting anyway. So biodiversity, for example. Biodiversity has very little impact on net zero carbon in a school, but it's an important thing for children to be learning about. So therefore, it ought to be included in the school curriculum. Waste management is important. But funnily enough, it has almost no impact at all on a school's carbon footprint. But it tends to be a thing because it is palpable and relatively easily understood. It tends to be a thing that schools focus on very early on. So I suppose, again, a fairly long answer to a fairly straightforward question. One of the things that I would encourage schools to get right is work out why they're doing the things that they're doing. Is it net zero carbon? Is it net zero for energy? Is it the broader sustainability, the United Nations 17 Sustainable Development Goals? Work out the purpose of each activity. You can do all of it. I'm not saying don't do anything. I'm saying do all of it. But work out the purpose of it and work out the priority and make sure that what you're doing matches the purpose that you seek and that you're giving it the due priority. And if at some stage, as a school, you are deciding, right, we want to tackle the big ticket item, which actually is estate decarbonisation. And within that estate decarbonisation, we want to tackle a really big ticket item, which is heat decarbonisation, no longer burning oil, LPG, mains gas, I think coal's all gone by now, no longer burning those fossil fuels for the generation of heat and hot water, then you're going to need to focus on it. And you're going to need to find the capital outlay to pay for it, because there are no significant grants to get it done. Unfortunately, not in the independent sector. There are in the public sector, but not in the independent sector. Even though independent schools nearly all have charitable status, in that sense, they do not often qualify for grants, the grants that are available to the public sector. It's going to be very expensive and it needs to be focused on. I suppose my concern would be that if schools get engrossed in the other things, they will ignore that big ticket item and it'll come back to bite them in years to come.
Yeah, I think from speaking to bursars of late, there seems to be a really tangible awareness of things like putting in solar panels, whether for heat or electricity, or, you know, starting a electric car scheme alongside a cycle to work scheme. And these things are all quite sexy, but perhaps don't do as much good as they think and also cost a not insignificant amount of money. Is there something to be said in actually not spending the time thinking about these things and actually biting the bullet and starting to think just about, you know, the estate decarbonisation and the reconsidering of heat production, for example? Is that something that's good advice, or is all of it helpful?
It's a perfectly reasonable question, but the answer is it's all helpful. And the answer is that if you want to get to the right answer, you need to think of it all at the same time. You need to think of the estate as a system. It's actually a system of systems. It needs that systems integration becomes very important. And you need to think, let's just rewind a bit. If the way that most estates are configured at the moment, running on fossil fuel, they have decentralized heat generation. So bursars and school estate staff, and actually everybody else, gets used to thinking of buildings as buildings in their own right and entire unto themselves. One of the features of the net zero school estate, when you get to it, is that a lot of schools will go onto a thing that we call a district heat network, where heat is generated in one, possibly two, maybe three, but only a few places, and then piped around the school estate. And the building by building approach may very well not work. All buildings will need to be catered for, but it will need to be done on a statewide basis. Power generation is the same. Yes, you can think about, let's put a bit of solar PV here, let's put a bit of solar PV there, and so on. But in the end, it will be much more cost effective if it is done on an estate-wide basis. And because of the relationship between low carbon heat technologies and power, bearing in mind that the solution is very often going to be heat pumps, and heat pumps use a lot of power, heat should not be considered in isolation. Power needs to be considered at the same time. And because the answer for school transport is going to be electrification, in other words, it's going to be electric vehicles, it's not going to be hydrogen, and we can talk about that if you like as well, everything is going to become electrified in most school estates. And therefore, it would certainly make sense that the things that are using the electricity, the heating, the school vehicles, the small power systems, computers, lights, that sort of thing, are all seen from a statewide holistic basis, because the power generation needs to be available around the entire estate. I'm not sure if that's come across quite as clear as I hope, but the message is, be holistic in your approach.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. To me, that explains that actually I think for a lot of bursars, hearing that turning to more things that are going to be electric is actually probably a horrible thing, given the cost of electricity at the moment and the continuing turmoil that is causing that. But actually, in incorporating electric producing, technologies in school, that's the only way that that's ever going to not completely bankrupt the school. But there'll also be an initial outlay for that as well. So there's steps to it, I suppose. Is it chicken and egg, or is it, put into place the production of electricity before putting into place all the electric stuff, or is there a real trade-off there?
There is a trade-off to some extent. There is no reason not to get on with installing on-site power generation, but you want to make sure that the amount of on-site power generation you are installing matches not only the current but the future requirement of the school estate. So you do need to know, how much power am I using now? Right, well, then I want to put in the required amount of on-site power generation to mitigate that. You're not going to put in, it's very unlikely that the school is going to be able to put in so much power generation at this stage that it gets to net zero for energy. That's a sort of pipe dream for a few lucky schools, but not for most of them, especially those in dense, built-up urban environments. So that's the power that I'm using at the moment. I should factor that into my plans. But I also need to know, for future planning, how much power am I going to need in 5, 10, 15 years' time, whenever I get to the big ticket items that I've been talking about. So I need to aim off for that as the person planning for the school. The bursar needs to aim off for that. Now, it may be that the answer to those two things is one and the same. Actually, we're just going to go for broke now. We've got lots of spare land and we want to put up our own school solar farm, or we want to put up our own school wind turbine or turbines, so that we can reduce our reliance on the grid as much as possible, as soon as possible. That makes eminent sense, and I would get on with it. It's going to be expensive, but I would still get on with it, because in the end, it will save the school money. But I would want to be sure, as someone responsible for advising the school, that in making the calculation of how much power, on-site power generation to install, the school was cognizant of what its ultimate power usage was going to be. You don't want to put too much on. I mean, it's unlikely you're going to be able to do that, but If you know what you're going to use in future, 5-10 years time down the track, then you will have a better idea of what it's sensible to do now.
I suppose the difficulty with that is that, you know, nothing ages faster than today's idea of tomorrow. So it's quite difficult to judge what the future electric usage might be, or even whether technology, perhaps you can answer this, will technology develop in the next 5-10 years so significantly that it's worth holding out for some advancement? Or is it the case that actually the longer you leave it, you're just putting yourself back?
There's nothing coming along in the pipeline that's going to make a significant difference at the strategic level, you know, whether to do this or not and when to do it. The technologies are all already known. The technologies, one could assume, will become more efficient, but none of those improvements in efficiency are going to change the fundamentals. A lot of people are holding out for hydrogen, and it's a pipe dream, no pun intended. Hydrogen for net zero as a whole will be very important. It will, of course, have to be what we call green hydrogen, meaning that it's clean, it's low carbon hydrogen, expensive to produce, but it will be very important. But there will be some functions which can only happen with hydrogen. There are none in schools, and therefore that valuable thing called clean green hydrogen will be hived off for those uses, and it's highly unlikely that there will be enough left over to put it into uses where other technologies will work actually rather better. Hydrogen for heating buildings is often seen as a pipe dream by certain politicians because it's convenient and easy, or seemingly convenient and easy, and it allows us to, you know, kick the problem down the road. There are a lot of studies. At last count, I think it was approaching 40, if not slightly more than 40, by independent experts, which have concluded that hydrogen for heating buildings will be not only rather dangerous, okay, you can mitigate the danger, but it's still more dangerous than mains gas, but crucially, significantly more expensive to run than current operating costs on mains gas. And I've read various calculations saying that if you look at the supply chain as a whole, 6 times more expensive. Well, in the end, it's the consumer who pays for everything. So if it's 6 times more expensive to deliver clean hydrogen from start of the supply chain to the end user, the boiler in the school, it means that the operating costs, the fuel bills are going to go up by 6 times. That's probably the main reason why hydrogen for heating buildings is a non-starter. So don't hold out for that. That's the one technology that people talk about a lot. All the other technologies are already on the table. And I'd probably say don't wait. I'd actually, in order to determine when a school should do things, I'd probably be looking more closely at forthcoming government policy. And one has to be careful talking about this because a lot of it is political intent. It's not yet in legislation, but it's coming down the track. And if we're serious about net zero as a nation, it's going to be enshrined in legislation sooner or later. We come back to heat and transport and power. And there is a very important principle that the government has rightly put forward, that we should use the natural replacement cycle for replacing fossil fuel plant. And what that means is that we are not going to, we as the government, you notice how I'm promoting myself now, I have absolutely no intention of standing for parliament, so don't let that one even start to run. We are not going to enforce domestic consumers, schools, anyone else to rip out perfectly serviceable fossil fuel plant. But what we're going to do is we're going to set a date after which you are not allowed to replace fossil fuel plant which has come to the end of its life, or whether it's a planned end of life or it's just broken suddenly in the night, the bursar's nightmare. You are not going to be allowed to replace that with like-for-like fossil fuel plant. So in other words, you're going to have to go to one of the low-carbon alternatives. And if we come to heat, that is going to be biomass, often by exception is obviously an oxymoron, but by exception, it's going to be biomass. Most of the time, it's going to be heat pumps of one sort or another. The date which is being talked about in policy circles at the moment for that deadline for sites on the gas main is 2035. There's a review out called the Skidmore Review, which is suggesting that that date should be brought forward to 2033. Either of those dates, that's a decade away. So you could wait. That indicates that you don't have to get on with replacing your heating plant imminently. That is not a reason not to have a plan, because it's still going to be blooming expensive when you have to do it. But it means that you don't need to rush. The equivalent date being talked about for those schools which are fortunate in that they're out in the country, but unfortunate in that they're not on the gas main, is 2024. Now, I don't think 2024 is going to come to pass, because it's so imminent that to get it into legislation with all that that means, it probably can't be done in time. But if it's not 2024, it might be 2025, might be 2026. The point is, it's imminent. So that would be a reason for those schools to be getting on with not only planning for how they're going to decarbonize their heat, but starting to work their way down the projects, because these projects take time. Then it's not as straightforward as just taking out one fossil fuel boiler and putting in another one. That's an illustration of how policy can affect timeframes for the replacement of the heating plant, which you've got to do sooner or later. What about installing on-site power generation? Well, let's say that you're that school on the gas main, which is probably about 85% of the audience, the school on the gas main, as opposed to out in the country not on the gas main. Does that mean that you therefore necessarily have to wait until 2035 to also install on-site power generation? Absolutely not. Get on with it straight away, because it's going to save you money from the get-go. What you do need to do is you need to ensure, as we've already discussed, that when you are doing it, when you are planning how much power generation you're going to install on your site, you are doing it cognizant of what the ultimate demand on that system will be. So we need coherent planning. We need to see the school estate as we need to approach it holistically. We need to see it as a system of systems. We shouldn't do anything in isolation. But that does not mean to say that we need to tackle the whole estate in one big bang. We don't at all. We should time things to some extent according to the policy, but also to some extent according to what is going to save us money sooner rather than later. The other issue we haven't talked about at all is building energy efficiency. Building energy efficiency is often overhyped in terms of how much energy it's going to save, and therefore how much money it is going to save the school in terms of reducing operating costs. But it's still got to be looked at. And there's absolutely no reason not to get on with looking at improving your building energy efficiency straight away. Yes, do that. Make sure that you've converted all your lighting to LEDs. You don't need a consultant to tell you to do that or to sort of devise a program for you. Just go and find contractors and get on and get it done. Every day that schools continue to use old-fashioned lighting, if I could put it like that, incandescent lighting as opposed to LEDs, every day is a day that they are effectively wasting money, because old lighting just costs so much more to run.
Okay, gosh, that was quite a lot of info there, and it's interesting that so much affects the timeframes, I guess. I'm aware that I want to keep this reasonably succinct, so we'll probably call it a day there, but we will do another one, well, a number more of these, diving into the various tendrils that this sort of shows, because there's so much to get into here, as we've discussed even from the past half hour. But the final sort of closing remarks from you, if I may, if you can give me one key thing, one statement that, you know, perhaps bursars should finish this podcast with an actionable thing to do, what would that one thing be that you think is the best place to start or makes the biggest impact that they can do right away?
Go and get an estate decarbonisation plan drawn up, because then you will know where you stand. Is that all
right?
There we are.
Yeah, perfect. That was an ideal soundbite. We'll use that. Nigel, this has been great. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, absolutely. We'll catch you soon.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
And there we have it, the end of this Friday special episode. Thank you very much to Nigel for coming on to talk us through all of those topics. We'll have him on again soon to venture into another avenue of decarbonisation and sustainability, so keep an eye out for future episodes. Otherwise, please do get in touch at podcast@theisba.org.uk for any topics you'd like to see us discuss, or just to say hi. If you do find these useful, please make sure to subscribe wherever it is you're listening to make sure you never miss an update. The next episode of the BursaCast will be out next Thursday and followed by a Friday special. But in the meantime, have a wonderful weekend. Hopefully the sun remains with us. And farewell.